Okay, I would like to introduce the panel. This panel is on Mises and Rothbard, differences on economic theory and political economy. Our distinguished faculty panel include, myself excluded, Walter Block, David Gordon, Jeff Herbiner, Robert Higgs, Peter Klein, Guido Hulsman at some point during the panel, and myself. Okay, the format of the panel will be to have each panelist give a 5-minute presentation on some difference between Rothbard and Mises, and then after all the panelists have spoken, we will open it up to Q&A. So we'll go alphabetically. Walter, do you want to go first? No, yeah, just from here.
The differences between Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises on economics, Austrian economics, and on political theory. The two that come to me right off the top would be on political theory, anarchism. Murray Rothbard was a free market anarchist. Ludwig von Mises was not. He was a limited government theoretician, although his position could be interpreted, if you wanted to, as quasi-anarchistic because he believed you could secede and he had other provisos. So his position is usually interpreted as limited government minarchism, minimal government. But if you wanted to interpret it in a friendly way, you could interpret it as very close to free market anarchism, although he did make some point about opera should be a government provision and maybe defense or one or two other things. So it's a little unclear. The other thing on pure economics that comes to my mind is on monopoly. Murray's chapter in Man, Economy, and State, I think chapter 12, was chapter 10, yeah, I stand corrected, thanks, took the view that there could be no such thing as free market monopoly. If it's monopoly, it's due to a government prohibition of competition, and it doesn't matter how many competitors there are. It's free entry or legal entry would be a better way to put that. If you have that, you don't have monopoly. Whereas Mises believed that you could have, in terms of resources, like somebody could buy up all the copper or something like that, and then he would be a monopolist. So I think those are two differences between the two. The similarities are obviously much more obvious than the differences, but if you have to probe for differences, those are two that come to my way of thinking.
Okay, so next we will have...
I'm going to talk about differences between Mises and Rothbard on ethics. First, we have to say they're different in what they think the status of ethical propositions are. That Mises didn't think that judgments or statements of ethics are either true or false. He thought they were just preferences, and we can't say that they're true or false. However, he thought that practically all people had the same preferences in that everyone wanted peace and prosperity. So he said, how can we achieve peace and prosperity? And the fundamental way to do that is by social cooperation through the free market. So for Mises, although he thought that ethical judgments aren't, strictly speaking, true or false, he thought practically everyone had a reason to accept the judgment that the free market is desirable. So Mises can basically be placed within the utilitarian tradition in that he thought that what one's trying to do in ethics is ask what will lead to happiness for everyone or as many people as possible. And his answer, as I suggested, was the free market. But he wasn't a utilitarian in the sense that Jeremy Bentham and his followers have, in that you try to compute units of happiness and try to maximize them. He wasn't what's called an act utilitarian. Rather, he just was a utilitarian in this less strict sense that he thought that the ultimate purpose of ethics was to promote happiness. And he opposed views that took ethical judgments to be just things that are given to us, orders or commands that we have to obey, and he criticized such views, say, as found in Kant, at least according to his interpretation, as irrational in his view. They were just without basis, that really, if you wanted to support an ethical statement, you have to show how the policy advanced would support human happiness. Now, Rothbard, by contrast, did believe that ethics was a matter of judgments that could be true or false. And in his view, he was in the Aristotelian and Thomistic tradition. He thought that the criterion of good and bad or right or wrong in ethics would be what was in accord with human nature. And he developed a natural law ethics, especially in the first part of Ethics of Liberty. It actually, though, the conclusions he came up with tend to be quite similar to Mises. Certainly, Rothbard wouldn't have denied that the purpose of ethics is to advance human happiness. You could take Rothbard is saying as a specification of what Mises had in mind rather than a strict opposition to them. So I think the biggest difference between them in ethics is just on this matter of whether ethical judgments are true and false. We can also come up with more particular points of difference. For example, Mises accepted Hume's argument that there's judgments about what we ought to do can't be deduced from judgments, descriptive statements of judgment about what is the case. And Rothbard didn't accept that. He thought that if it's the case that something is a requirement of human nature, that human beings need certain things in order to flourish, that it would follow that they ought to act to achieve those things. Probably what I've said, haven't heard, you're better off that way. All right, well, I think that's, once was bad enough. I think that's about all I had.
Okay, I'll make a few comments about the differences, however slight they might be, between Mises and Rothbard on interest. And let me start with a difference in the expression of the principle of time preference, which forms the basis of their theory of interest. Mises was much more emphatic that time preference is a basic category of human action. Time preference you cannot derive from an even more basic concept of human action, but that it is just one of the basic concepts of human action. As Mises puts it, temporal beings recognize the difference between sooner and later. And to the extent that they're able to choose with respect to their action, with respect to this distinction of sooner and later, they always prefer to attain a given end sooner as opposed to later. If you read Man, Economy, and State, in the early part where Rothbard first begins to talk about the time preference, he speaks about it this way. He says, time is a means to be economized. Or he says in another place that man prefers his end to be achieved in the shortest possible time because time is scarce and a means to be economized. And that expression isn't quite correct, or at least it isn't exactly correct from the Misesian viewpoints. And I wouldn't go as far as to say that Rothbard and Mises disagree entirely on this point. You can find expressions like this in human action as well, like the ones that I quoted from Rothbard. But I think Rothbard's a little less explicit with respect to the character of time preference. Now, a second difference is a difference that you find more generally across other topics when you read Human Action and compare it to Man, Economy, and State. And this is that Rothbard develops the analytics of interest theory to a much greater extent than Mises does. He fills in the gaps. He goes through the steps of providing all the analytical apparatus. He develops the supply curves and the demand curves and shows us how the market clears and so on and so forth. And Mises doesn't provide this detail. And that wouldn't be an important distinction in and of itself, but it does lead to certain, again, expressions of the principle of interest that are somewhat different. For example, Rothbard, because he has developed all of these analytical tools, it flows from his discussion that you can say things like you have a time preference schedule that declines with wealth or something of the sort, where in Mises, he would say that this isn't so. He would say something like, a person's time preference doesn't depend upon their wealth or upon capital accumulation in society and their situation and so on. Now, both of those propositions are true. It's just that the Rothbardian proposition is true, ceteris paribus, right? You have to develop the analytics to say it in that way. And let me now move to just two more substantive differences. One is on the yield curve. Mises argues in Human Action that the yield curve must slope upward to the right, that short-term maturities have lower interest rates than long-term maturities. And he argues the reason for this is that the more remote an end is to be achieved in time, the greater the intensity of time preference. And so yield curves would slope upward to the right. Rothbard, to the contrary, says that the yield curve would be flat. At least he claims this in the ERE, an evenly rotating economy, the yield curve would be flat. The interest rate on short-term loans and long-term loans would be the same. And he claims this because he says that there is there are financial markets in which you can arbitrage across differences of interest rates. So if you had a higher long-term rate and lower short-term rates, people could take advantage of this and arbitrage across the difference. They could sell out of their long-term, the markets make their long-term contracts liquid, so they could sell out of them. And this would create equal time structure of interest. Again, it may not be that this is much of a difference because Mises's argument, he admits, is made in the real world, and Rothbard says this would hold only in the ERE. But I think it is a difference where Mises says that the reason why the yield curve slopes upward in the real world is the intensity of time preference, whereas I think Rothbard would claim that if the yield curve slopes upward in the real world, it's because of uncertainty. This would be a more standard view. And then finally, I'll comment on the biggest difference, I think, between Mises and Rothbard in interest. Both of them have the same four categories of components of the market rate of interest. So the market rate of interest is constituted by the pure rate of interest based on time preference, by an entrepreneurial uncertainty component. Different investments have different entrepreneurial riskiness associated with them, and so higher riskiness means a higher rate of return. There's a price premium, as they call it, based upon Cantillon effects. And they agree on that point. But it's the fourth category they disagree on. The fourth category is the inflation premium, the premium in the interest rate that is based upon the changing purchasing power of money. And Mises takes Fisher's view that if people anticipate correctly the future state of the purchasing power of money, then they will build into the interest rate a component to account for this. And Rothbard, very famously in Man, Economy, and State, disputes this. And he says only if the future purchasing power of money is unanticipated, the change in it is unanticipated, will this get built into the rates of return. Because if everyone anticipates higher prices in the future, let's say, the entrepreneurs will bid more heavily for factors of production today, and the rate of interest, the rate of return, will actually conform to the time preference rate. It won't have this inflation premium in it today.
My topic is differences on war, and here Rothbard and Mises differ starkly, and a lot could be said about how they differ. Let me only say that these differences reflect overwhelmingly, I think, the fact that Mises was a classical liberal who favored minimal government and but definitely favored government. He describes government as the most beneficial and important institution and as essential for the maintenance of the market itself, whereas Rothbard favored no government whatsoever in the sense that we know government now. So let me just read some passages from Mises about war, and then a few passages from Rothbard, and I think they will speak for themselves. I'm reading from Human Action, the third edition, which Mises prepared in 1966. It was the last one he made. Peace, the absence of perpetual fighting by everyone against everyone, can be attained only by the establishment of a system in which the power to resort to violent action is monopolized by social apparatus of compulsion and coercion, and the application of this power in any individual case is regulated by a set of rules, the man-made laws as distinguished both from the laws of nature and those of praxeology. The essential implement of a social system is the operation of such an apparatus commonly called government. One has to deal with the often raised problem of whether conscription and the levy of taxes mean a restriction of freedom. If the principles of the market economy were acknowledged by all people all over the world, there would not be any reason to wage war, and the individual states could live in undisturbed peace. But as conditions are in our age, a free nation is continually threatened by the aggressive schemes of totalitarian autocracies. If it wants to preserve its freedom, it must be prepared to defend its independence. If the government of a free country forces every citizen to cooperate fully in its designs to repel the aggressors, and every able-bodied man to join the armed forces, it does not impose upon the individual a duty that would step beyond the tasks the praxeological law dictates. In a world full of unswerving aggressors and enslavers, integral, unconditional pacifism is tantamount to unconditional surrender to the most ruthless oppressors. He who wants to remain free must fight unto death those who are intent upon depriving him of his freedom. As isolated attempts on the part of each individual to resist are doomed to failure, the only workable way is to organize resistance by the government. The essential task of government is defense of the social system, not only against domestic gangsters, but also against external foes. He who in our age opposes armaments and conscription is, perhaps unbeknown to himself, and a better of those aiming at the enslavement of all. The maintenance of a government apparatus of courts, police officers, prisons, and of armed forces requires considerable expenditure. To levy taxes for these purposes is fully compatible with the freedom the individual enjoys in a free market economy. And there are many other passages I might read that move along similar lines. Let me now read just a few passages from Rothbard, and I'm reading from his essay, War, Peace, and the State. Rothbard says, in condemning all wars, regardless of motive, the libertarian knows that there may well be varying degrees of guilt among states for any specific war. But the overriding consideration for the libertarian is the condemnation of any state participation in war. Hence, his policy is that of exerting pressure on all states not to start a war, to stop one that has begun, and to reduce the scope of any persisting war in injuring civilians of either side or no side. Highest priority on any libertarian agenda, therefore, must be pressure on all states to agree to general and complete disarmament down to police levels, with particular stress on nuclear disarmament. It is in war that the state really comes into its own, swelling in power, in number, in pride, in absolute dominion over the economy and the society. Society becomes a herd seeking to kill its alleged enemies, rooting out and suppressing all dissent from the official war effort, happily betraying truth for the supposed public interest. The root myth that enables the state to wax fat off war is the canard that war is a defense by the state of its subjects. The facts, of course, are precisely the reverse. For if war is the health of the state, it is also its greatest danger. A state can only die by defeat in war or by revolution. In war, therefore, the state frantically mobilizes the people to fight for it against another state under the pretext that it is fighting for them.
Well, I will be very brief. My subject is fractional reserve banking, so the difference between Rothbard and Mises on fractional reserve banking. Rothbard, in that respect, had, of course, a very good starting point. He took over, by and large, the economic analysis provided by Mises and brought to bear a different ethical point of view than Mises, which has already been discussed by Dr. Gordon. So I will just highlight the fact that Mises' thought on the economics of fractional reserve banking evolved somewhat from his earlier publications, most notably The Theory of Money and Credit, first published in 1912, to his ultimate statements in Human Action, and then also in the fourth edition of The Theory of Money and Credit, the English edition, American edition, published in 1953. What Rothbard did was to take over the final conception of Mises, which slowly emerged in the 1920s and then came to be expressed in Human Action and also National Economy, which was published in 1940. So what were the differences? What was the evolution of Mises' thought on this issue? In the 1912 book, Mises' originality consisted in adopting a point of view and defending an interpretation of banking that was at odds with the majority of his contemporaries, and which still is at odds with the majority of banking and monetary theorists today, which is what makes one of the reasons that it makes Mises still relevant today. It's still worthwhile to read Mises today because precisely he develops ideas that are at odds with the so-called banking school interpretation of the role of money and banking that is still prevalent today. According to this banking school interpretation, an elastic money supply is a good thing. The money supply should follow the demand for money. So if the demand for money increases, then the money supply should follow suit. And the other way around, if the demand for money diminishes, then the money supply should diminish as well. This adjustment of the money supply to the demand for money is best guaranteed in competitive banking by fractional reserve banks. Fractional reserve banks alone have the possibility to increase and to diminish the money supply within certain limits. If all banks were operated on the principle of a money warehouse in which each sight deposit in each banknote had to be backed 100% by underlying base monies, like gold and a gold standard, then it would not be possible for the banks to increase or diminish the money supply above or below the level defined by the base money supply. So the money supply would be inflexible. So Mises states from the outset, and here he takes over the position that was developed by the so-called currency school in the mid-19th century, states from the outset that the money supply is irrelevant from the point of view of society as a whole. It is no benefit to have, no overall benefit to have a flexible or an elastic money supply as compared to an elastic one. And he also attacks the idea that there would be, in fact, in, for example, in competitive banking, such a thing as an elastic money supply. Mises argues that, in fact, the fractional reserve banks do not adjust their creation of money tickets to the needs of trade. Rather, they tend to go as far in creating money tickets. They have an incentive to create additional money tickets because they earn interest revenues on those credits. They have an interest to go as far as possible, given the limitation that comes from having to redeem their money substitutes into base money. So banks tend to be, as we should say today, tend to be fully loaned out. And as a consequence, it's not possible for them, if there is an increase of the demand for money, it's not possible for them to simply increase the creation of banknotes of side deposits. Then Mises stresses that the only way for banks to go on and increase the money supply further would be to cooperate. And cooperation can be spontaneous between otherwise competing banks, but it can also be institutionalized, and it can be even enforced by a government-imposed central bank, for example, and also by something like a World Bank. So Mises, in his money book, in the Theory of Money and Credit, he plays through the different scenarios that one can imagine in order to create conditions that are particularly favorable for the increase of the money supply through banks. And he ends up with the result already known by the currency school, that to the extent that banks cooperate and to the extent that you centralize and monopolize banking, the money supply becomes indefinite. Now, the increase of the money supply per se, Mises does not condemn. And here we have a big difference as compared to Rothbard. The problem that Mises sees is not related to the increase of the money supply per se and the resulting increase of the inflation rate, the price inflation rate. The problem concerns the intertemporal misallocation of resources. And so to the extent that banks can increase the money supply, they tend to reduce the interest rate on the market for loanable funds below its equilibrium level, and as a consequence, funds are channeled into production projects that are not viable. This is the whole Austrian business cycle theory. So Mises says that is the main reason, and that was already the reason highlighted, though slightly different scenario, highlighted by the currency school, for which credit expansion and increase of the money supply is harmful from an overall point of view. So even though the increase of the price level or decrease of the price level ultimately is not to be condemned or to be recommended, this reason alone would speak against fractional reserve banks and also against fiat money. Now, because Mises adopted not a natural law point of view but a utilitarian point of view, he condemns fractional reserve banking not categorically, that is, not come what will, so we need to get rid of fractional reserve banking, but only to the extent that there was a big likelihood that fractional reserve banks would cooperate and through cooperation would increase the money supply. Therefore, he was against the continuation of the gold exchange standard as from the 1920s. And therefore, he strongly recommended, when it became obvious and patent, that banks not only were cooperating, but were in fact reinforcing their cooperation and centralizing it around the Federal Reserve after World War II. Therefore, he strongly opposed this cooperation and urged a return to the effective use of gold as money. Now, Rothbard, Rothbard builds on the final analysis that Mises had developed in Human Action, and he is much more categorical. What he says is fractional reserve banking is unjust because it, through the Cantillon effect, it creates revenues for Group A at the expense of Group B, and as a consequence, whatever benefits one might construe to result from this, it has to be outlawed. So fractional reserve banking is not legitimate, and fiat money is not legitimate either because it always involves violations of property rights.
So I was asked to say a few words about monopoly theory, and as Walter mentioned, there are some important differences between Mises and Rothbard's treatments of monopoly, though overall they have their discussions have much more in common. They have much more in common than might be obvious. Both Mises and Rothbard emphatically rejected the mainstream neoclassical treatment of monopoly that was becoming increasingly standard in the 1930s as Mises was beginning to write the book that became Human Action. Both of them reject the idea that monopoly exists whenever there is a deviation from competition, with competition being defined in the neoclassical sense of perfect competition, perfectly competitive general equilibrium. So they rejected the idea that monopoly exists when a firm faces a downward sloping demand curve. So they both agreed that no firm faces a perfectly elastic demand curve and that all sellers have some influence on the price of their product. They rejected the idea that firm size or the number of firms in a market or the magnitude of the ease of getting into a market or getting out of a market were critical determinants of market performance. They did have some differences, though. Mises believed that monopoly as sort of a condition of the market was not important, but there was such a thing, Mises believed, as a monopoly price that could be distinguished in a free market from a competitive price. And Mises thought that this monopoly price obtained only in a strictly limited set of circumstances. There are two conditions in Mises' theory that must hold for a monopoly price to emerge. One is a unique seller or a group of sellers with exclusive control over the supply of a particular good or service that consumers wish to purchase. And second, the demand curve, the market demand curve for this good or service must be inelastic above the price that would clear the market under competitive conditions, such that the seller would find it profitable to reduce supply, to withhold some of the stock of the good from the market in order to increase the total revenue from selling a reduced supply. Under those conditions, limited conditions, Mises thought that the principle of consumer sovereignty, by which the market allocates resources in a way that satisfies the demands of consumers to the greatest extent possible, could be violated. In other words, this withholding of supply from the market when consumers would have been willing to purchase those units of the good or service at a price above the cost of production was in some way a violation of the principle of consumer sovereignty. Now, Mises did add that in a free market, it's very unusual that those circumstances would obtain. There might be a few particular cases like a generation of electricity, maybe mining or producing coal or bricks or something. But in the vast majority of cases, Mises argued, the monopoly price would only obtain when the government intervened to restrict competition with a group of sellers, when the government was enforcing the monopoly through exclusive grants and privileges, creating entry barriers and so on. Now, Rothbard, while agreeing with the substance of, while sharing with Mises the causal realist approach to pricing and markets that derives from Menger, thought that Mises erred in trying to distinguish a monopoly price from a competitive price. Rothbard argued that in a free market, there's simply no way to distinguish the actual price, to know whether the actual price that obtains on the market is a competitive price or a monopoly price. All prices in a purely free market are competitive by definition. And it's worth noting that Rothbard rejected Mises' concept of consumer sovereignty as a criterion for the overall welfare properties of the market, favoring instead an amended notion that he called individual sovereignty, meaning that the preferences not only of the consumers, but also of the producers or the sellers must be taken into account, such that even if it were the case that a seller or a group of sellers believed that they could increase their total revenue by withholding some of the stock of a good or service from the market, that preference should be taken into account as well. And that if we include everyone, producers and consumers, even in a case like that, there's no violation of anyone's ability to demonstrate preference through action and so forth. So Rothbard believed that the only praxeologically meaningful way to define monopoly is in terms of state-granted privileges for particular producers. You know, the East India Tea Company or whatever being granted the exclusive right by the British Crown to or the Dutch Crown, as the case in either case, to trade, to work in particular trade routes, or the grant of a patent or a copyright by the government. A local public utility that has an exclusive license from the state to provide electricity or telephone service or whatever it might be. So those are the only cases in Rothbard's view in which it made sense to talk about monopoly conditions obtaining or a monopoly price obtaining. Otherwise, you simply have the market price, the price that obtains from the free interactions of buyers and sellers. But again, it's worth pointing out that both Mises and Rothbard shared the same general view on pricing, on competition, on markets, and also that there was a lot of discussion of monopoly and monopoly theory by Austrians prior to Mises, and Mises' views, as expounded in Human Action, represent a fairly mature statement of an Austrian monopoly tradition. That was well established at the time that Mises was writing. So Rothbard's views can be interpreted as a clarification or an extension of the conventional Austrian approach to monopoly rather than a wholesale repudiation of Mises' approach.
I assign myself the topic of the differences between Mises and Rothbard in monetary theory. And there's two basic concepts that they differ on. The first is the definition of the money supply. In America's Great Depression, Rothbard defined the money supply very broadly as all bank deposits that are payable on demand at par, meaning without any cost. And for Rothbard, it did not matter whether or not these deposits were subject to transfer by check. So he included savings deposits, the deposits at mutual savings banks, the shares of saving and loan associations and credit unions. He even included the cash surrender value of life insurance policies. So later on, he wrote an article in the 1970s on defining the Austrian theory of the money supply, and he did drop the cash surrender value. He called it the Austrian money supply. And then I did a little bit more work on it, after discussing it with him, and we came up with an aggregate that we call the true money supply. So basically what that aggregate is in terms of today's monetary aggregates published by the Fed, it's really M2 minus certificates of deposit, because you cannot withdraw your money without penalty before the certificates mature. Okay. So for Rothbard, the principle was that what he called the interchangeability criterion, any item that was immediately interchangeable with dollar bills on demand at par was properly included in the money supply. Now, let's look at Mises. Mises only counted currency plus demand deposits, that is, checking accounts, in his aggregate. And writing in 1912, this was a step ahead or an advance in economics, because even Irving Fisher, who was Milton Friedman's favorite American economist, refused to include savings deposits and even demand deposits, checking accounts, in the money supply. Okay, he said they were very money like and they had a velocity and so on, but he didn't include it. So Mises really took a step forward by doing that, but he stopped short there. In fact, regarding savings deposits, okay, which he did not include, he did point out that in the 1920s and 30s, banks had an increasing tendency to convert or redeem these deposits without due notice, because previously these deposits were considered investment deposits, short-term investment deposits. He also argued in an article in the 1930s that, in fact, if you looked at savings deposits, they were being treated all over the world as if they were just demand deposits. And he said that this was the reason why, part of the reason why there was such monetary chaos and there was exchange rate instability. But then when we come to human action, where he again defines the money supply, he refuses to include savings deposits in his aggregate because they're not subject to check, so therefore they're not a medium of exchange. But he did acknowledge at one point that they were, in effect, demand deposits. But yet he wound up by saying that they were only secondary media of exchange, like government securities and so on. That is, they weren't part of the cash balance itself. So that is a significant difference between Mises and Rothbard. I think Rothbard took a step forward there. I'll stop there. Yeah. Okay, we'll take questions.
Do we have any questions from the audience? Sir, can you stand?
I do have two questions. One is relevant, and the second one maybe not. The first one is, what's the position of Rothbard or Mises on a multiple currency?
I don't hear you.
Multiple currency.
They believe that there could be parallel currencies that would circulate side by side, and Mises even said that you can look on international trade as parallel currencies because people who engage in international trade use both currencies or use more than one currency. So, in fact, they both pointed to the gold and silver when they weren't subject to the price controls under bimetallism, that was a perfectly legitimate standard.
My second question is, do the Austrian School of Economics believe in a brand protection?
The Austrian school takes no position on that. That's an ethical question. Maybe David can say something about it, but that's ethics and not economics.
A brand is a kind of property. Is it seen as a kind of property of a business?
Well, that's a political ethical question.
Question? Yes, sir. Would you please stand and accept the mic?
If I understand correctly, Rothbard was Mises' student at one time. Is that right?
Not formally.
Okay, I'm not well-versed in the history, but when I read Man, Economy, and State, I think I remember seeing some points where Rothbard said, I differ from Mises. Did Mises ever say, you're right, I'm wrong, to any of the points that you discussed?
Not quite so directly, but there's it's reported that on the monopoly question, for example, Mrs. Mises reports that there was a meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society, and this I guess in the 1950s, the guy who had translated Human Action into Spanish asked Mises if there were what he thought of. That must have been 1960s after Man, Economy, and State. He asked Mises what he thought of Rothbard's monopoly theory, and depending on who you ask, Mises either said, I think Professor Rothbard's work is extremely important, or I do not disagree with the word that Professor Rothbard has written on monopoly. I can't think of another case.
My question is for Dr. Salerno. I've read on the web that you've said that one of Rothbard's contributions was that he integrated Mises's time preference theory with a Hayekian structure of production approach in his five chapters on production theory, and that was something that Mises didn't really elaborate on, possibly because it had a whiff of the Bumbavarkian average period of production, something like that. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Jeff, do you want to talk about that, or do you want me to? Yes. Well, Rothbard read very widely. Didn't just read the Austrian economists, but read many of the American economists of the American psychological school. And so, on the one hand, he got a strand of pure time preference theory from Frank Fetter, who was acknowledged as the leader of that school, and who Jeff Herbert has written an article about. And on the other hand, Rothbard did read Hayek very closely, and Hayek, based on Wicksell, Wicksell's reading of Bombaver, more or less formulated the structure of production. So, as you said, Mises never really talked in terms of the structure of production. He just talked about capital goods and consumer goods and different stages of capital goods. So what Rothbard did, I think, which was a great achievement, was to combine both strands, the physical structure of production strand with the subjectivist, thoroughly subjectivist, pure time preference theory.
My question is about the topic of the panel itself. I'm just curious, since we talk about... Can you hear me? My question is about the topic of the panel itself. Since we refer to Menger as having been the founder of the Austrian school, I just find it interesting that in this panel, in particular and in general, I hear much more about Mises and Rothbard than about Menger. So I'm just kind of curious, why is it that you would talk about what are the differences between Mises and Rothbard than, say, you know, the differences between Menger and Mises? And why is the focus so much more on Mises and Rothbard in general, it seems, than on Menger?
I guess it is. Yes, because Menger was the founder, and he wrote in 1871. Mises' great treatise came out in 1949, Rothbard's in 1962. They are considered the sort of the fathers or godfathers of the modern Austrian revival. And so since their work is the most relevant and all-encompassing, they're the ones that most directly affect us. But that's not to say that Menger isn't important. I mean, without Menger, there may not have been a Mises and Rothbard, or at least the works written by these men in the same way.
It wouldn't have been Mises.
Yeah, Mises, in fact, said reading Menger's Principles around Christmas of 1903 is what turned me into an economist.
My question specifically on Mises and Mises' view of the state and conscription and armed forces. So I guess... do you think that was largely attributable to his being raised and grown up in the political culture of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, with the centrality of the central state being the arbiter of rights and maintaining the liberal order? Do you think it was involved with that?
Mises' view of the state was the same view of the state that practically all classical liberals held. They all believe the state to be essential. They look to it to define and enforce private property rights and to maintain social order. So they look to the state to provide what some people call the social framework of the market. And they suppose that markets couldn't operate successfully without such a framework. And they did not believe that anything other than government as we know it could serve to fulfill that function. None of the classical liberals was an anarchist. Anarchism was a very eccentric strain of thinking. It was largely outside the stream of classical liberalism in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And so there wasn't anything extraordinary about Mises' position in that regard. Now, I think Mises' personal life situation might well have contributed something to his views. It's never really possible for us to do more than conjecture about why people adopt all the views they hold. We're all the creatures of everything that we've encountered or been exposed to in our lives. We need to remember that Mises was born in the early 1880s in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and when he grew up, he was like other bourgeois gentleman expected to be an officer in the army, and he was. And during World War I, Mises served in the Austrian army for several years in combat. And if you think about Murray Rothbard, you cannot imagine Murray in the army in any capacity other than locked and wound up in chains. For Mises, there was nothing extraordinary about defending his country, and he spoke with high praise for the state. He thought the state was not the lesser evil, but in fact the most beneficial of all institutions, because without it we could have no successfully functioning market economy.
Just one thing I'd like to add. It's, of course, quite true that Mises supported the state, but on the specific issue of conscription, he changed his position in National Economy and also in some later pamphlets. He was opposed to conscription. He thought that the market would supply soldiers better than the conscription. So in the first edition of Human Action, he doesn't mention anything about conscription. It's only in the second edition that he does it. So it's not clear why he changed his mind. It might have been that he was very concerned with the communists and the Cold War, but his support for conscription only comes quite a bit later, unlike his opposition to anarchism. That's really a later development. So I don't think it would follow because of his experiences in the Austro-Hungarian Empire that he supported conscription, because he didn't at that time.
Question over here?
Just keeping on the topic of war, Dr. Higgs, considering the contemporary situation with the U.S. and the military-industrial complex and the current economic incentives with their wars in the Middle East, do you think Mises would have altered his position in regards to the U.S. example?
Well, this is pure conjecture, of course, but Mises was very clear that he opposed imperialism. He was against that. He always favored the extension of the market economy and the kind of division of labor it allowed as widely as possible. And he certainly favored peace over war. I think if Mises were alive today and observing how the U.S. government has conducted its foreign policies in the past several decades, my best guess is that he would find this terrible, that he would be very much opposed to the way the U.S. government is conducting its foreign affairs, because it goes far beyond any reasonable defense of the social framework of the market economy in the United States or the world, for that matter. It's just a kind of blundering around by a leviathan that imagines itself capable of dominating the entire world for purposes that are not always clear, other than domination in itself. Some people have argued, number of people have argued, that simply maintaining these 1,000 foreign bases is why we're there, because they're there and people want them to stay there. Every one of them has a general in charge, and that carries a lot of weight. Chalmers Johnson basically makes that argument in his trilogy on the military state. But there are many reasons, I think. I don't subscribe to any simple theory of why U.S. foreign policy is conducted as it is, and it obviously is a large element of just blunder and happenstance. But I cannot imagine that Mises would have been in favor of what's going on.
I wanted to comment on a previous question, the question about the overall panel. Why Mises and Rothbard, not Menger, but I wanted to answer in a different way. But before I do, I wanted to just add two more things. Mises never used supply and demand. Murray Rothbard did. Mises never used the triangle, the structure of production. Murray did. So there are many, many differences between the two, and probably if we searched, we could get some more. One of the things that bugs me is that Gary Becker and James Buchanan told me personally that Austrianism is a cult or a religion. And my assessment of this is here you have gigantic differences, or many, many minor differences, or some significant differences between two of the leaders of the Austrian school. And this is a little bit incompatible with it being a cult. If it was a cult, you'd have a schism. But we all, seven of us, have disagreed with other things other than Mises and Rothbard. Maybe one day we'll have a panel on that. But the point is, but the point is that it's pretty much the opposite of a cult. If all the leading members of it are feel free to disagree with each other on points in a friendly way, but disagree, it can't be a cult.
Thank you very much.